Where's the end of war, freedom from disease? Where's the milk and money, see the shining sea? And where are all the crime-free cities, rockets on our backs? And where are the smooth-moving sidewalks? Hey, where's my jet?
Spoilers for Wicker Man Original and Remake, The Wicker Tree, and Midsommar.
Kia ora koutou, welcome comrades to Where's My Jetpack, a politics and pop culture podcast with sci-fi and socialist leanings. Halloween is up there with Pride Month as one of our two favourite months of the year on this podcast. So we're bringing you 2 weeks of Halloween episodes. Next week will be a roundup of horror classics we overlooked last year. But speaking of classics, this week we've got Lucy Buchanan on to discuss classic folk horror The Wicker Man, as well as the Nick Cage remake, the spiritual sequel Wicker Tree, and the sort of unofficial remake Midsommar. Lucy is a fan of all the stars, that's Trek, Wars, and Battle, along with Godzilla and Horizon Zero Dawn, among others. She's starting a Master of Arts at the University of Auckland. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for coming on. So, do you want to kick us off with a review of the original Wicker Man?
Absolutely. So, The Wicker Man 1973 is just honestly one of my favourite films of all time. Makes me so, so happy to get to talk about it here. So, yeah, let me give everyone a quick reminder of the plot. Spoilers for this 49-year-old film. So, a God-fearing Church of England stiff upper lips detective travels to a remote Scottish island to investigate the report of a missing girl. Upon his arrival, he is stonewalled by the villagers and realizes to his shock and horror that the people of the island have reverted back to a construction of old pagan beliefs. He comes to believe that they mean to sacrifice the girl he came to find to ensure a bountiful harvest after the failure of last year's crops. In fact, his purity and unwitting foolishness have made him the perfect sacrifice. He is burned to death in a giant effigy while everyone sings a jaunty tune to one of the best-timed finishing shots in all of cinema history. The end. So, yeah, there's just so much that I love about this movie. It's such a slow burn of revelations, such a great use of a shoestring budget. And the music, I mean, it's a musical, it's a folk musical. It plays on so many different emotions, from like hippie folk joy to like sensual and menacing. There's this constant clash of both the modern and the old, the establishment and the periphery. Like at the beginning of the film, he flies in on a water plane, which is in itself an intrusion of modernity into this rustic rural lifestyle. And the village he comes to at first seems so mundane and quaint, but these are people that are ultimately comfortable with committing a murder for reasons that a thoroughly modern mind would find unfathomable. So the main character, Sergeant Howie, is constantly trying to impose the authority of both his political position as a police officer and his faith onto what he sees as the anarchy of the island's lifestyle and sexual degeneracy. And in the end, it's this authority that dooms him, because he's the representative of the queen, of the state, and that's one of the requisites for a proper sacrifice in the village's eyes. And like, when it comes down to it, there's no good side in this film. The Wicker Man came out at a time when there was rising interest in folk religions, but also a rising tide of reaction against them within the Christian establishment. So people seeing this film might have had sympathies on either side. I'm sort of tempted to be team pagan villagers, but at the end, they're all taking part in a heinous act that isn't rationally justifiable. And they're disturbingly cultish. And I'd like to think most of us have sort of an instant aversion to seeing any group of people behaving so creepily in sync. But in this film, as opposed to certain remakes that we'll discuss in a minute, the nature of the island hive mind is very slowly revealed, and that's to great effect. Howie's self-righteousness immediately turns me against him, but you can't help but feel sympathy for him as he acknowledges his death and then screams in abject agony as the flames consume him. And I just want to have a little bit of a rant about the final shot, because I just love it so much. The Wicker Man effigy is a concept that we get from Caesar's commentaries of the Gallic War, and he said that it was used as a sacrifice of criminals. Here it's been repurposed. It doesn't contain criminals, but instead a representative of the law of the establishment. And this is what that giant figure symbolizes, I think, in this film. As it burns, and keep in mind on the budget of this film, they only got one shot at this. They build a giant effigy, they have to burn it. They're not going to be able to burn another one. It crumbles in front of the camera to reveal the most perfectly timed shot of the setting sun, which is the object of the cultist's worship. So kind of in a way, the sun is triumphing, but at the same time, it's a waning sun, which might indicate that Sergeant Howie's last words to Lord Summer's Isle, that the sacrifice won't bring back the crops and that his control is unsustainable, is actually kind of true after all.
No reason to believe that their religion is, you know, in some way supernaturally correct. But exactly. that's a really interesting reading of that last sequence, which is definitely like, as a sort of occasional amateur filmmaker, that getting that particular shot, you know, would be such an exciting moment, realizing that's the shot you managed to get, kind of thing.
Yeah,
as you say,
and
with
I've seen some documentaries about it and just their excitement when they talk about it, like, yeah. It absolutely was for them.
Yeah, like as you say, like relatively low budget, they do pull off quite a technically impressive thing in the first place with the Wicker Man, and then they get just that perfect shot. It is really impressive. But yeah, I also, you know, obviously I agree about just the fantastic sort of creepy slow build. I think one thing that's really great about it early on is that there are all these things that could just be sort of mundane and benign, but they're just a bit off. And you know, we know, because it's a horror movie, that, you know, that they're building to that, that these villagers are all in some way sort of malicious, but at the same time there's so many things that could be innocent and that he's reacting to, kind of thing. And it's sort of this sort of sense of uncanny and like and things that aren't necessarily directly threatening, they just sort of feel a bit off. And then like there's I think one thing with, compared to the 2006, where there's some quite jarring tonal shifts in that which don't work, this has some quite jarring tonal shifts, but they work. So like you mentioned that it's a musical, but like most of the musical performances, in a way, they're sort of in a certain way naturalistic, in the sense that it seems that these people are just gathered around kind of singing a song, part of the diegesis. But then Willow's song, the sort of sequence with Britt Eklund, and I understand she was overdubbed and stuff, but basically the sequence where she's kind of trying to tempt him to basically give up his virginity, which would, you know, make him not such a tonal, such a virginal sacrifice. So he could have actually, you know, possibly averted his fate by giving in to temptation. But that sequence is really strange, because it's almost this music video where she's performing direct to camera, and it's really stylized, and it's like of the musical sequences, sort of feels the most like a sort of a shift out of like any kind of element of naturalism. And the fact that it works at all is really impressive, because it's so sort of jarring and so strange to have this kind of music video kind of sequence of her sort of tempting the camera in that way. But yeah, it's just sort of part of the all sort of kooky weirdness of the environment.
I'd say there are two sort of scenes that do that, actually. So definitely that one with the How Do song, that is an amazing piece. But also when Howie's driving to Lord Summerisle's house, and it's the women jumping over the fire singing the Take the Flame Inside You song. That would also be a place where I think it feels almost slightly less diegetic than, say, the pub songs, and it's got this very dreamlike aesthetic. It's like this very unreal scene that he's taking in as he drives to the Lord's house. But again, like, it works. It very much seems like it works in the tone of the film, and it, that these people, yeah, very much could be participating in this. It just naturally.
Yeah, I think part of it is that it represents his kind of experience of this strange kind of discordant place. So I think the reason the sort of weird tonal shifts work is because it's supposed to be weird. You know, it's supposed to be unsettling and bizarre and sort of jarring. But like,
yeah,
I think
they're not dramatic. They don't feel like. Like, we know, we'll talk about it with the 2006 remake, but every tonal shift in that just feels like a punch in the face.
And not in a good way. But yeah, that sounds weird, punch in the face and not in a good way. But sometimes films punch me in the face, and it's like, yeah, that was perfectly landed. In this case, it's just like, why did you do that? Like, I don't understand. Like, but yeah, like, I think a good example of the kind of culture clash thing that you were talking about, and it's also a good example of this kind of, okay, this is unusual, but is it actually dangerous kind of thing, is the classroom scene where the teacher is sort of teaching about the phallus, which we all worship kind of thing. And it's like, okay, yeah, that's a bit weird. And like, it's, I almost think of it in terms of, well, it's not exactly great separation of church and state, aside from the church being like a pagan cult. The fact that she's saying that we all worship, you know, it is this kind of slightly brainwashing thing to talk about we in that kind of sense in a classroom environment. So it's not something where I can endorse their side of it, obviously. But then when the cop comes in, he's sort of talking about this filth, you know, this filth you're teaching in schools, and it's resulting in brawling and pubs somehow. And she's like, I wasn't aware that it's, you know, the police's purview to deal with what's taught in classrooms. And I'm like, yep, that's bang on. What's a cop got to do with that? But at the same time, it's like, as I say, she is also teaching this sort of group, you know, groupthink cult sort of logic in classroom. So it's just this funny moment of like, he's as you said, he's this representative of this kind of reactionary conservative order, and they are this sort of culty pagan mindset, and you really don't have to sympathize with either. And in that way, it's kind of has an interesting kind of alienation effect where, you know, I think we shouldn't talk too much about 2006 until we've actually talked about it, but it's kind of the opposite of the 2006 one, in that I don't think there's any sense in the 2006 one, despite Nicolas Cage's performance being off the wall. I don't think there's any sense that we're actually supposed to, like, disagree with him. There's no, like, self-awareness about it. Whereas in this, it's like, it presents it so starkly, like, when he's being burned alive, or just before he's burned alive, he's, like, raving about, like, God, and, like, he turns full Bible basher,
singing "The Lord is my shepherd."
yeah, and like, so it's so stark, and like, you know, even in the 70s, like, you know, I'm sure there's going to be a lot of people who support the Church of England, but there's, as you say, aside from people who would be sympathetic with the Pappy movement, it's also a secular enough society that a lot of people are still going to be like, what the fuck? Like, this, you know, they're going to see the Bible bashing and find it a bit strange. So it makes it harder to sort of straightforwardly sort of sympathize with someone who is essentially the protagonist and the hero. Like, we're sort of alienated from the hero, which I think is a really interesting device. But yeah. I was also thinking what you said about the sort of the intrusion of the modern into the sort of the ancient or the revival of the ancient which is interesting also, in that he's representing something that could be considered tradition, like Christianity as tradition, but it's kind of a more recent tradition than specifically the Church of England is a much more recent tradition, but even Christianity itself is obviously is more recent, and paganism, you know, we can talk about neo-paganism, that it's actually not in direct continuity with the ancient or whatever, it's a reconstruction of it, but you know, it's interesting that the modern intrusion is a Christian modern intrusion. But it also, I mean, it reminds me of a lot of British kind of horror and that, like, it's a relatively common trope that someone from, like, the metropole, even also in American horror as well, that someone from the metropole goes out to somewhere that's sort of still developing, and for a lot of the 20th century, like, that was the case, that, like, some places had only recently really been sort of developed in a sense, as in the UK. So, like, it's sort of, in a way, this is like the flip side of if anyone's seen Quatermass 2, which we've reviewed, which is, you know, another British kind of horror. But in that, he's this scientist. He's going out to this British, like, sort of village environment, and there's this new sort of factory that's been built nearby. And you have these people who essentially, like, they have only recently experienced industrialization. And in that case, it's like the industrial is this sort of violent imposition, and that's the sort of villainous thing. And it's sort of idealizing village life, that the village life is being displaced by these sort of malicious industrial forces. But yeah, here it's more this, like, the sort of theoretically ancient kind of pagan thing, that then in the same moment is also, as you say, tied in with the hippie movement. So it's just all very contradictory in like an interesting way, you know, what we consider to be traditional or modern, and, you know, what also competing forms of order, like although he perceives them as, like, as you say, anarchic or disordered, it's actually two sort of competing kind of structures of order in a way, or groupthink.
Actually, they have this very traditionalist English pastoral lifestyle where you have a lord, you know, they all defer to him. He's still this, so there's still sort of a class structure for them, if you will.
Yeah.
So it's interesting, because it is almost this very traditionalist British hierarchy, yet it practices paganism, which in modern Britain is not considered traditionalist.
The phallic symbol. That is correct. It is the image of the penis, which is venerated in religions such as ours, as symbolizing the generative force in nature. Oh, can I help you?
Could I have a word with you, please, miss?
Certainly. Yes. Open your desk and take out your exercise books.
Oh,
Miss, you can be quite sure that I shall report this to the proper authorities. Everywhere I go on this island, it seems to me I find degeneracy, and there is brawling in bars, there is indecency in public places, and there is corruption of the young, and now I see it all stems from here. It stems from the filth taught here in this very schoolroom.
I was unaware that the police had any authority in matters of education.
Well, we'll see about that.
Do you want to go ahead with 2006 remake review?
I shall. So, The Wicker Man 2006. What a different beast we have, because this is, in my opinion, one of the worst films ever made. I'm not even sure it fits into the so bad it's good category, and that's not casting any shade at Nicolas Cage. He's easily the best thing about this movie, but even he cannot save this absolute abject disaster of a remake. So yeah, just go watch the funny bees scene on YouTube that incidentally is in the theatrical cut of the film, and allow me to describe the events of this travesty to you. So, a cop with plot contrivance PTSD travels to a remote island off the coast of Washington State to investigate the disappearance of the daughter of his ex, who suddenly left him years ago. The island, it transpires, is both matriarchal and pagan. For some reason, this horrifies him, in spite of the fact that nowhere do we see that he has any connection to patriarchal religion. He finds out that the child is his daughter because for some reason we need to up the stakes. He comes to believe that the islanders mean to sacrifice the child to ensure a bountiful honey harvest, because, you know, bees. He's very allergic to bees. Of course, he is the true sacrifice because, well, he came there willingly, and that's about it, apparently. Legs are broken, bees happen. His daughter lights the effigy on fire, and he burns alive to a really boring standard closing shot. The end. So, I've spent far too much time thinking about why this is a bad, bad movie. Because the worst thing is, at times I think it could have almost been okay. The scenes in it that they lift directly from the original are usually pretty fun. There's a bit at the beginning where Nicolas Cage is mouthing off to the woman stonewalling him when he lands on the island, and it's my favourite part of the film. He's just so funny in that bit. But where the original movie had the slow burn, quiet menace, this one is about as subtle as a brick to the face. It begins with a horrific accident that seems to serve no purpose in the overall plot of the film. Malice, Cage's character, his PTSD advances nothing in the plot that wouldn't have been equally served by him being just like a little freaked out, but we had to find something to shoehorn in to replace the religiosity of Howie. For some reason, he can't just be a police officer doing his job out of duty, he has to be doing it for some relational connection. We can't just have a quiet and creepy example of the cruelty of all the villagers as shown by the actions of their children, like in the weird beetle scene in the original classroom sequence. We have to have a goddamn Corvid jump scare. And then, of course, there's the misogyny. Because matriarchy is inherently evil, everybody, don't forget that. The Woms get to be in charge, all men will be second-class citizens, and human sacrifice will be back in fashion. And the film so clearly frames the society as being against nature and a part of the horror of the film. It's more gross than the mutilated pilot corpse that gets sprung on you as a freakout. Basically, this film goes the Disney live-action remake path and tries to over-explain everything in the plot, resulting in nothing actually making sense. The implication at the end is that they purposefully send women out into the world to hook men just in case they need a sacrifice, which I kind of feel detracts from the sinister nature of the final sacrifice being an act of desperation and faith. It's like all plotted years ago.
What is that? Oh, no, not the bees! Not the bees! Ah! Oh, no, my eyes! My eyes! Ah! Ah!
Yeah, that ending sequence of the woman in the bar kind of flirting with the men and sort of drawing them into the cult, I think is a really funny one. And it's interesting because cults actually have used those sorts of techniques. It's called like flirty fishing.
Oh, yeah.
Where yeah, we're
children of God.
Yeah, we're basically that relationships are deliberately used to draw people into cults. But in this case, it doesn't come off as a sophisticated exploration of cult dynamics. And we'll talk a little bit about how I think Midsommar does a much better job of further exploring the kind of cult dynamics. In this case, it just really feels like an extension of the extreme misogyny of the film. The fact that it sort of ends with the sequence in a bar with these women flirting, and it's kind of like, well, you can't trust them, and ends with like a close-up of like a flirting woman's face while you hear screams on the soundtrack, and like the fact that like, so yeah, I think that's like a really funny choice of closing shot, you know, as opposed to, you know, as you said, the beautiful closing shot of the sunset. This ends with just a close-up of a woman's face, because that is the true horror of the story, is woman. And yeah, there's literally no good woman in the movie. And the fact that even the little girl is part of the scheme, I think
is the one who burns him in the end. Like,
yeah. And I think that it's in a way, like in the horror genre, in the context of the horror genre, it's not unusual for children to sort of not be innocent. Like the creepy child is a common trope. But in the context of this film, it sort of feels like an extension of the fact that all the women are evil, even the little girl is evil. You know, his ex was part of a plot to entrap him. These random girls at a bar are like entrapping men. Like the little girl is part of a scheme, deceptive scheme to win him over. It just really feels like, you know, women are just untrustworthy and dangerous. And it's sort of explicitly spelt out with the big backstory dump Ellen Burstyn comes on to give as the kind of the leader, where she kind of explains that this was a society where they basically decided to have a matriarchy, and that's the backstory, it's a matriarchy and that's bad. And like he tries to like rouse the men of the sort of island, and the men are too passive, so it's like these men are beaten down and oppressed. So it's like, it just really feels like the threat in this movie is just woman. And there's also just no self-awareness at all. And it's really bizarre because Nicolas Cage is giving the most bonkers performance, but at the same time, the film doesn't seem to be in any way reflexive about his character. Like, I don't think there's any indication in the film that we should in any way like distrust him in some way. In other words, in comparison to the original, where you have these kind of interesting, much more deliberate, I think, distancing effects with the lead character, in this it's just like he's just a guy. Like he's a sort of a modern guy, as you say. He has PTSD, which maybe is supposed to make him more sympathetic. Like, it doesn't feel like they're saying this guy is a representation of patriarchy as like a philosophical clash. It just feels like
there's no religious aspect to him whatsoever. And even as a police officer, there still doesn't feel like this contention of the state even so much that there was in the original.
You could very easily forget that he's a police officer. Like, he's just this guy who happens to be Nicolas Cage, so his performance is bonkers. Like, other than that, the film, there's nothing in the script which seems to indicate that in any way we're supposed to have any distance from his perspective. He's like an everyman who just happens to be also Nicolas Cage. But like, it doesn't feel kind of self-reflexive or self-aware. It just feels like it's simply presenting the sort of the matriarchal cult as evil, and as sort of clashing with our society. Like, Nicolas Cage is on our side, it feels like, as the script is sort of presenting it. And then that also, there's some shots which are really questionable in the film, where, okay, so Nicolas Cage basically inflicting what is essentially self-defensive violence is understandable in context. but it sort of feels like the film is relishing the fact that he can just go around punching women. Like, it sort of,
really
it's,
does.
Yeah, it's sort of like, yeah, it feels like the movie is just thrilled about the fact that he can just go around punching innocent looking women because actually in context it's justified, and it all just feels very off and very poorly thought through. And also, I mean, considering the talent involved, like,
oh my god, yes, such great actresses involved.
Yeah, yeah. You have Alan Burstyn again as the sort of leader of the cult, and she has nothing to do. She has basically two big info dumps, and she doesn't really manage to rise above the material. I think she just falls flat because she's the way she's written, you know, like she's not able to transcend the incredibly poor writing they give her, which gives her not much to do. And like, Ellen Burstyn is not someone you would expect to fall flat. Like, she's an incredible performer, because the material she's given is so flat, she does. And like, Nicolas Cage is the only performer in this that stands out, despite being by far from the only performer with talent. And then you've got like Angelo Badalamenti, who's one of my absolute favorite score people. What's the word for a score person? You know, scorers.
Composer?
Composers, yeah, film composers. delivering a pretty mediocre score.
Yeah, it's nothing special.
And then, yeah, like, there's nothing, because he can deliver these really atmospheric scores, but it's just a fairly standard orchestral score. I don't know whether he thought he was doing anything interesting, but he really isn't. And then you've got Neil LaBute, who at the time was a very reputed sort of writer-director, and he'd come from a theatrical background. And I think he really discredited himself with this. Like, I think this is a large part of the reason that essentially Neil LaBute has not become kind of a household name, because he just made this piece of complete schlock with really classic material, and it's just amazing, because it's a film full of A-listers, and it's sort of like barely a B movie. I don't know. Like, it's just such a squandering of like great material and talent. But also, like, I think, yeah, again, the profound misogyny of it, which I think the big problem with it isn't even that it's a matriarchal cult. It's that it doesn't set up any philosophical juxtaposition to make that interesting. Like, if it felt like Nicolas Cage was in some way like deliberately more so a representation of patriarchy, that could be an interesting like clash. And
that's why I'm saying that it makes little sense that he's so horrified by matriarchy and paganism. It's like, sure, he could be a little weirded out by it, but he's like, from the very beginning, abjectly against it. And it's like, there's no real rational reason why you would be as a modern person. You'd just be like, yeah, okay.
It's a little weird, but you know.
It's a little weird, but we'll move on. But he's, from the very beginning, he's like, oh, this is really messed up.
Well, yeah, because he escalates immediately, which is also part of, yes, it's, you've got Nicolas Cage in your movie, but, you know, it's like he sort of goes straight to 11 with his reaction to everything, even though, you know, much like in the original, early on, there's not really much that's happening that's, as you say, overtly malicious. Like, he just immediately is just like, yeah, furious at everyone and just being kind of a total dick. But like, again, there's no way in which the movie is using his kind of being a total dick to set up a juxtaposition. It just feels like it's siding with him because again, like, what is he actually supposed to represent? I mean, yes, he's a, as you say, yes, he's a cop. He's not religious. The script doesn't do anything to indicate that he's like especially sexist, like not in any particularly self-aware way. So it's just like, what philosophical clash are you setting up other than like matriarchy bad versus normalcy good. Like, it's like the alternative to matriarchy is just normalcy and like contemporary American society. Like, that's
yeah,
it doesn't
set this film in the modern day. It really doesn't make any sense to be just matriarchy bad.
It is bad, but
it's just a terrible film.
Yeah, and it's really unfortunate also, you know, because I talked about the talent involved, but it's also like the production isn't bad. Like, a lot of it looks quite nice, like, and you know, and that's...
Oh, it's very pretty.
Yeah, and that's to do with it having kind of a decent mid-level budget, but we're not going to review Wicker Tree in full, but I might sort of slightly use that to segue into Wicker Tree, because I think it's an interesting flip side to that in a certain respect, in that it's clearly a micro-budget film. Like, the money and even... Yeah, it is brilliant. But even Wicker Tree 2006, despite being really bad, the money is kind of on screen, and in Wicker Tree... the lack of money is kind of on screen. Like, you can see that it's a micro-budget movie, but they do far more interesting things with the material, and it is also the writer-director of the original Wicker Man, and is kind of he refers to it as a spiritual sequel. So it's not the plot doesn't directly follow on from the events of the original, but it's kind of a similar story where basically these American religious kind of fundamentalists visit an English village that has, again, you know, a bizarre pagan cult. And I think this, like, it's something like 25% on Rotten Tomatoes. It's really held in low regard. But I think we both agreed it was actually a much more enjoyable and a much more interesting follow-up to the original, because...
Well, like I said, the 2006 one, I feel, didn't even make itself into the so bad it's good category. Like, it's actually just fundamentally not an enjoyable film, whereas the Wicker Tree is campy and fun and literally enjoyable.
Yeah, and I think it knows that it's ridiculous, and that's the fundamental problem with the 2006 one, is that it doesn't know how ridiculous it is.
Yes.
Whereas Wicker Tree completely does. Like, and it has a great sort of sense of alienation effect with the protagonists, because they're these extremely, like... I don't, with no insult to the sort of the Americans or I know America is a couple of continents, but people from US in the audience, like, they are just very American and very like Bible Belt. Like, anyone who's not a Christian fundamentalist watching this is going to find them hard to relate to, because just everything about them, their whole aesthetic, even like there's a couple of funny sequences where they kind of play the male lead as kind of a cowboy. They even have like this twangy cowboy music, and he is kind of dressed in that sort of Midwestern style as a cowboy. So it's sort of this, it definitely has that alienation effect that the original has, where they're kind of these representatives of basically fundamentalist kind of evangelical US Christianity, and, you know, obviously the pagan cult is a pagan cult, but it has that culture clash and the self-awareness and the way that you don't have to agree with either of the sort of clashing sides. But it also is also essentially a camp comedy. Like, it is overtly comedic, and I think that's
absolutely
That's what people bashing the film, I think, don't seem to get, is that it's being clearly deliberately comedic. I mean, there's sequences in it that like strongly remind me of League of Gentlemen, for example, the British comedy League of Gentlemen, just in terms of how it plays, especially the villagers. Like, it's this, I think, in some ways very British style of comedy. But when I say British, I think there's a lot of things that people could associate with British comedy, but in this case specifically like British camp comedy essentially. And I think having these sort of North Americans in this context, it's kind of like, again, we're almost drawn to sympathize more with the pagan cult, but not really.
I think less so in the Wicker Tree than in the Wicker Man.
Yeah. I mean, I think more to the point, we're certainly not drawn to side with the evangelicals, and they are evangelicals, and they're completely clueless. Like, when the Mage Queen is chosen and it's the female co-lead, she seems to still think she can use her position as May Queen to like propagate her evangelical Christianity, and it's like,
yeah,
that's not gonna work. And how do you, like, you can't, like, they're played as so incredibly clueless, and like this is an old horror movie trope to have kind of incredibly clueless victims, but in this case it very much feels like a kind of a cultural satire on these sort of North American evangelicals just simply not understanding on any level the situation they're dealing with. And yeah, it's just a lot more self-aware and a lot more comedic. I think others might disagree, but I personally would have liked to see some gore. Like, I feel like that would have pushed this.
All right, yes, this is where we're going to disagree, because I'm not good with gore.
Yeah, and I don't think all horror movies need gore. The first movie doesn't have any in it. It's a great horror movie.
I can see where it would have fit in with this film.
Yeah, like there's a sequence where essentially this guy is half castrated by the heroine. And they're like, there's another woman from the village who's like stitching him back up, and it's kind of that sequence where she's stitching him back up is a good example of what to me reads very much like a League of Gentlemen kind of style comedy. But like that feels so like it's getting into the kind of schlock movie territory of just really ridiculous violence. And there's one sequence with like some blood which is kind of intercut, but I think this to me is like an example of how it's very clearly on a budget, as I feel like this movie on even a slightly higher budget probably would have gone for gore effects. Speculate, like it feels like that sort of movie, that it would be just a bit it would be fun if it just had a bit of gore to kind of in a kind of a campy vein. They also have Christopher Lee for all of like 10 seconds.
Oh, the cameo.
Yeah, and I kind of feel like maybe it's pitched to a very specific audience. Like, if you love the original Wicker Man, if you love Hammer horror, if you love like camp kind of horror, then you might really enjoy this. But if you're not into those things, it might just not play for you.
You probably just think it's ridiculous.
Yeah, which it is.
Which it is.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. But I think it's a lot more willfully ridiculous than Wicker Man 2006.
It takes joy in its ridiculousness, and that's why I rather loved it.
Yeah, it's like, because, you know, it strips out all of the subtlety of the original film, but that is part of what makes it such great fun, I think, is that it has zero subtlety in a way that's just really enjoyable, whereas, you know, the original has this kind of slow build. This is just the same.
The 2006 strips out all the subtlety, but minus any self-awareness, and so it just falls completely flat.
Yeah, it sort of tries to play it straight, and again, as you said, the only redeeming aspect being Nicolas Cage. And if the 2006 movie was, if everything else was pitched at the level Nicolas Cage is pitched at, then that would be a so bad it's good movie, you know, when
potentially, yeah.
Like that, not, you know, and I'll say I respect Nicolas Cage as an actor, but if anyone's seen the Community episode on is Nicolas Cage good or bad. I somewhat then they sort of propose a series of theories on whether he's a good or bad actor, and I kind of side with the Shirley Bennett school of thought, which is maybe he just acts good in good movies and acts crazy in bad movies for drug money. And I think that 2006 is very much an example of the latter, you know.
Yeah, I tend to think he's actually a good actor when he has like good direction and a good script. He can really pull off certain types of work when he's directed well, and if he's just let fly to do whatever he wants, then it's a train wreck.
It's a very enjoyable train wreck, though. And even yes. like even his sort of slight bonkersness, like that can be done used really well. Like I think two interesting examples of this are Mandy and Color Out of Space, which were kind of coming out of the period where he had made a whole series of really bad movies, and he admits that this was just basically for the money, just accepting any role that he could get. He also defends his acting choices in those performances, but he admits he'd just take any role that was offered to him. But I think this is coming out of that period, and they're both kind of B movies, and they're both kind of deliberately campy, kind of much like Wicker Tree, and they both use his really bonkers off the wall style of performance really well. Like they know what they're doing when they're using Nicolas Cage that way. Whereas Wicker Man 2006, it's like he's just kind of there doing his own thing. Like I think part of the problem again is that there's no sense of escalation, you know. He just immediately goes up to 11, which is great fun to watch, but it's sort of like, yeah, it doesn't it's part of just the film not really adding up to all that much. But so it's kind of, they kind of waste Nicolas Cage and his bonkers performance. But again, I think if the rest of the movie was pitched at his level of just insanity, then it could be a fun bad movie to a greater degree than it is.
If either they'd done that, or if he had toned it down at the beginning and ratcheted it up to that point at the end, like one of those decisions could have been a good decision, but what they did was terrible.
Yeah, it just doesn't work. And as you say, like the best thing to do is probably just to look up the most bonkers Nicolas Cage scenes on YouTube. You know, you'll get all the entertainment value of the film from that.
Enjoy those. Don't subject yourself to the whole film.
Yeah. Unless you're a real obsessive completist, it's not something we'd recommend. But yeah, but Wicker Tree is in the sort of somewhat deliberate, so bad it's good category. I think it uses the material, the ridiculous material, in a more self-aware way.
Give the Wicker Tree a chance.
Nice to meet you, sir. Ma'am.
See our silver rings? They're the same rings.
I try.
To show that you're engaged? As a sign of our chastity, ma'am.
Well, I guess it don't appeal too much to some young folks here, but thanks to your invite, me and Beth, we've come over here to try and change that. Right, baby?
They're both perfect. I was afraid we'd have to look further afield this year. What a little star, especially if she can sing. And rather beautiful, too.
In a corn-fed apple cheek sort of way.
Perfect made for a cowboy, then.
Absolutely. I bet she smells of the dairy. A musky bush, milky tits, and just a hint of warm cow shit behind the ears.
So you approve of her, then?
Oh, and that poor Steve, wearing that ridiculous silver ring and waiting to his wedding day. It really is another world over there in America, isn't it?
Yeah, we're gonna move on to one of the other descendants of the original Wicker Man. In this case, I'll be reviewing this one. We're talking about 2019's Midsommar. So this is a movie that's been accused of being a ripoff of Wicker Man, and my take is that it's a better unofficial remake than the official remake. So I mean, just to go all the way and compare Ari Aster to Shakespeare. Shakespeare ripped entire plots from existing works, his major innovations being in dialogue. So I tend to think sometimes when people get a bit too fixed on cribbing, you know, I understand the problems with plagiarism, but I think sometimes you can use existing material in a new way, and I think Midsommar does that. So it does something sufficiently novel with the material to justify its existence, I think. And so as I sort of touched on, it's written and directed by Ari Aster. I had trouble with his debut Hereditary, mostly because of the kind of emotional bait and switch in that, and it kind of took me a while to come around to that one. But even with my issues, it was still clear that Aster was incredibly talented, just on a technical level, if nothing else. He's a very talented director, but he deals with some quite challenging themes, and Midsommar was different from Hereditary in that it just unambiguously landed on the first watch, so I loved it right from the first watch, whereas with Hereditary, as I say, I had some trouble with it, and I think some of that is the deliberate way that he's messing with the audience in that movie. But Ari Aster knows trauma. It's very apparent to me from his work that he knows trauma. I don't know a lot about him as a person. I don't particularly want to. That's just a thing about artists in general. I'm not that interested in their biographies. But just from his films, he knows trauma, and that really informs his approach to horror. Like, it's just really deeply felt in this throughout, I think, Hereditary and Midsommar, and just really played in a really effective way. And he knows how to craft a movie in general. Like, if you've seen his films, you'll know what I mean. Like, just the visual construction, the mise-en-scène, the sort of the way that each shot unfolds, and each shot unfolds in relation to all the other shots. Like, it's just sort of really deliberate construction that's just really impressive. But I'm not sure he likes people very much. There's maybe a bit of touch of misanthropy in his work that I detect. But onto the movie. So for those who don't know, in Midsommar, Danny, played by Florence Pugh, is in a relationship with Christian, the very on-the-nosely named Christian, played by Jack Renoir. And their performances are both bang on, and that's kind of essential because this kind of has this melodramatic element to it. Like, the relationship drama is really important. So Danny has experienced a horrific family trauma, and Christian is essentially resentful of being in a relationship with her, but not communicating that. Or to be more precise, he's not saying it to her. He communicates it constantly with his body language and tone that he's resentful of being in a relationship with her. And his friends are the absolute worst, including Chidi from The Good Place, William Jackson Harper, as a hilarious caricature of an anthropology postgrad. It's super weird seeing Chidi as a bad person. It's almost like William Jackson Harper is an actor and Chidi is a fictional character. But another in that friend circle, probably the other of the sort of three most important of that friend circle, with Christian and Chidi, sorry, I forget the actual character name, is Pele, played by Wilhelm Blomgren. And he's also the worst, but he's good at emotional manipulation. So he seems like the good one, the one good guy in that friend circle, especially on the first watch. Obviously, where these are spoilery reviews, but on the first watch, he seems like he's the one who's actually emotionally supportive. And I think some misreadings of the film kind of take that at face value when there's a lot of manipulation involved in that. So he also happens to be a member of the Hogga, a Scandinavian cult, which is like a red rag to the bull of anthropology postgrads. So they all end up on a deeply dysfunctional summer holiday to Sweden. And just a note here, there's a very specific camera move as they approach the site. The camera flips as it centers on a white supremacist banner in Swedish on the way. And this is the first of a number of signs that this is, in fact, a white supremacist cult, including particularly their fixation on preserving a pure bloodline. Unlike in The Bad Wicker Man, this isn't a matriarchal cult per se, but it is one that idealizes maternity and femininity in a way that's inextricable from their white supremacy. So they kind of idealize the sort of the birth-giving function of women as a part of their white supremacy, or specifically of white woman, really.
Hmm.
And so the fact that they come to idealize Danny, you kind of need to see it in that context. But a lot of the horror is set during the daylight, unusually for the genre. And I think part of this is about creating a kind of glowing whiteness on more than one level. So that you have these all white robes sort of radiating reflected sunlight. So it's this kind of horrifying white supremacist utopia, essentially, that everyone's just kind of glowing, but in a way that's just a bit wrong, or very deeply wrong, in fact. And as the murdering inevitably starts, the people of color also die first, although this is also justified by the cult by their disrespecting the cult's rituals. So they sort of have that disclaimer, but it doesn't. Although you could say this is just a horror movie trope that the people of color die first, but I think Ari Aster has indicated that he was deliberately playing the cult as a white supremacist cult, so I take it as fairly deliberate. But full spoilers here, Danny is recruited as their May Queen and Christian is burned alive as Danny looks on, and her tears and sort of grief thaws, and she, in the closing shot of the movie, again, it's a great closing shot, much like Wicker Man 1973. The closing shot, she smiles as she's sort of wreathed with flowers, and it's this weirdly cathartic moment. It's actually a really surreal moment to have sort of, you know, you've just had this kind of horror, and then, you know, her face sort of breaks out into a smile. And a lot of this a lot of the discussion of this movie centers on whether to side with Danny or Christian. So it's become a meme in some circles to say good for her. And while this is the internet, so it's probably at least half joking, there's a certain emotional truth to it. We are drawn to sympathize with Danny. And I think what we discussed about the first Wicker Man is relevant here. You don't actually have to take anyone's side in this. So Christian's name is incredibly on the nose. Again, he serves a similar function to the Christian cop in the Wicker Man. So he's an outsider who's no more sympathetic than the murderous cult. But Midsommar's innovation is to flip the perspective, to give us the perspective of somebody who's recruited to the cult. So when, well, there's actually no indication that he himself is Christian, but he is kind of this outsider. When the Christian or Christian burns, we're not on his side, even in terms of just the protagonistic narrative structure. Like, we have seen some stuff from his POV, but in broad terms at this point, we're protagonistically on the side of Danny. So we don't have that thing in Wicker Man 1973 where, in terms of the narrative structure, we kind of have the protagonist of the cop. In this case, the protagonist, yeah, is on side with the cult when the Christian burns alive. And to be clear, Christian is a douche. He's emotionally negligent. He's passive in the worst possible way. He acts like being in a relationship with a traumatized person is some huge favor. He's incapable of openly communicating a single genuine emotion. He just kind of sucks. So as far as their relationship goes, I'm on Danny's side. I mean, on the first watch, I was shouting at the screen just in the first 10 minutes of the movie at Christian. So, not on his side. But as far as Danny being recruited to a murderous white supremacist cult, it seems obviously the idea of seeing that as a happy ending is a little absurd. So ignoring for a moment what happens to Christian, I think it's helpful to think about what happens to Danny. So she lost her entire family, or she lost her nuclear family. She's emotionally isolated. And due to Pele's involvement in all this from the start, the cult knows her situation. And at some point, we don't know when exactly, they set a plan in motion to take advantage of her isolation. So especially on rewatch, you can really see the sort of the strings a bit more, that they're manipulating her the whole time, really. And Christian, in a sense, was her last connection to the outside world, so they sever that connection. And it's not just by killing him. They also drug him and basically draw him into a situation where people talk about him cheating, but I think that's kind of a silly reading of a cult drugging someone and then drawing them into a ritualistic kind of sex scene. I mean, at that point, is it even really sex in the sense that it's not really particularly consensual in the sense that we would maybe hope. But the point is, they are manipulating the whole situation, and they take advantage of her sense of isolation and, you know, induct her into a cult. And I think Esther and Pew do a great job of keeping us emotionally with Danny. She's the center of the story, so in a sense, when she's recruited, we're recruited. And this makes it kind of the ultimate subjective portrayal of cult dynamics, because it recruits the assumed audience, and in fact, based on a lot of the commentary, a lot of the actual audience. And the sort of the catharsis at the end is deeply ironic and deeply satirical, I think. That moment of liberation, you know, there's a lot of layers of irony there with that sort of emotional payoff. But yeah, so it's a movie about cults that recruits both the lead character and much of the audience to that cult, essentially. So, yeah, did you have any thoughts on that?
I mean, full disclosure for the audience, I haven't seen Midsommar. When it comes to horror movies, I am, in fact, a giant wimp. And I know my limits, and my limits are most certainly Ari Aster.
Yeah, that's completely fair, yeah.
But I am sort of fascinated by it. I have watched pretty much every review of the film and every analysis of it that I could find, because it does seem to me to be a really interesting piece of cinema, but I have not actually seen it myself.
Yeah, and I'll never watch Cannibal Holocaust because of the animal cruelty, but I've also read a lot about that. I think that having your limits is fine. But yeah, did you have any thoughts on the kind of, I guess, the themes, but also how it relates to the other kind of, in the Wicker Man canon, if we can consider Midsommar part of the Wicker Man canon?
Yeah, well, I agree with you very much that it's sort of like, it definitely plays on similar points that the Wicker Man 1973 does. You know, you can definitely see parallels in the storytelling between the two films. But I think it does a lot of really sort of, it's a very extremely well-made film. It, whilst it borrows the points, it brings its own bits of originality to the story. It's in no way just a ripoff, and I think that's, yeah, if people say that it's just, oh, it's a ripoff of The Wicker Man, it's a really unfair way to compare the two. It's building on it.
I guess I shouldn't worry too much about YouTube comments, but, you know, don't read the comments. But I was looking at the comments on Willow's song, the song from the original 1973 Wicker Man, and there were a lot of people saying, like, oh, yeah, you know, Midsommar is a lesser ripoff of this kind of thing. You know, it's a thing that travels in certain circles. It's by far from being, like, the critical consensus or anything, but it's certainly a thing that certain kinds of nerds say. And I think, you know, it does have the same basic structure, so you have these outsiders coming into this kind of pagan context, and the sort of slow build of trying to figure out how actually malicious this pagan cult is, because, you know, initially we have no have no reason to believe that they're murderous, but we know it's a horror movie again. And then you know, the build to essentially them burning again the Christian alive, but that's, you know, that's kind of the bare bones of the story. Like, there's so many ways in which it's its own kind of distinct work, both in terms of the story and in terms of how it's directed. Like, it's clearly someone who's a fan of the original movie but has done something really quite different with it. But yeah, so yeah, it just, I mean, you can prefer the original Wicker Man, that's totally fair, but I think to just call this a lesser ripoff is not really reasonable. It just kind of borrows the skeleton of the story and adds different flesh to it.
It actually almost, if you think about it, it borrows the skeleton of the story of the 1973 Wicker Man, and it's inserting that whole aspect of the trauma of the central character of Danny being part of the reason she's susceptible to this cult. Almost feels to me like they've done right what the 2006 Wicker Man almost attempted to do a little bit with Malice having PTSD and being affected by that in his response to the cult, but actually doing it well and having a point and a purpose.
Yeah, we talked about when we were rewatching 2006 how they constantly have him sort of cracking open, I don't know, are they antidepressants? It's not really clear, but he's constantly sort of popping pills, and as you say, it's kind of movie PTSD or plot device PTSD. Although again, you know, as you also said, it's not really clear what purpose that device serves. It feels like a device, but it's not really exactly clear why it's there. And this definitely uses, it has a much better understanding of trauma in it, and it uses that understanding of trauma to inform the story of essentially being recruited to a cult. And, you know, that's the one consistent thing I think across these stories is, you know, is the pagan, the outsiders entering into the pagan cult environment. And I think, as I've said, the introducing the element of the protagonist actually being recruited is actually quite distinct. You know, that's you still have, again, as I've said, the character who is the Christian, the man who burns in the wicker. In this case, it's not a wicker man. It's sort of a triangle building. I forget what they call it. But he also burns also inside a bear. But in any case, he burns alive. But at that point, you know, at that point, he is no longer the protagonist. You know, when we talked about reflexivity and that both the original Wicker Man and Wicker Tree are kind of reflexive, and whereas 2006 really isn't reflexive, this kind of brings back the sense of reflexiveness, because, you know, there's not really any kind of perspective that we can fully trust in this. You know, there's the perspective of Christian, which we do actually have some POV stuff from his perspective, enough that certainly there are also audience members who side with Christian. And you know, you can see how there's an element of it having his POV in there, but, like, you know, it's also, he's also kind of presented as a doofus from Danny's perspective, and Danny is the primary protagonistic perspective, but is you know, by the end has been recruited by the cult, and you have the white supremacist cult. So essentially, you have a bunch of perspectives or forces or characters involved, none of whom you can really trust. You know, they're all kind of cast into question, and I think, you know, that, so there's an interesting piece on this in Blindfield's journal. It was Bordered Utopias is in the title. We'll link it in the episode description. So one point that essay makes is basically that in the context that a sort of a liberal white feminist reading of the film, essentially, which is kind of good for her, is kind of missing the imbrication of her position with white supremacy. That basically they've created this kind of bordered utopia, and she's been able to kind of purge what she didn't like from her old life, but that's only able to happen by creating this, well, literally inbred society. Like, they literally practice inbreeding, so it's this sort of bordered utopia which they construct by purging, you know, all the elements of the outside world, essentially. So her sort of liberation is basically contingent on this white, like partly white supremacist, but just in general this cultist logic of purging all the elements of the outside world, cutting people off from any ties they have outside the cult. So yeah, there's a very sophisticated portrayal of cult dynamics, but which is just lurking under the surface. Like, I think it's not quite spelled out, and you kind of have to rewatch it to kind of fully get all the machinations of what's happening on the cult side, like what they're actually doing. And even then, much like the 2006 one, they obviously had a scheme from relatively early on, and it's not really clear when they set that scheme in motion. But it just does a better job with the material.
Yeah, well, it's pretty hard to do a worse job, to be honest. But yes, I think it's interesting because too, in the original 1973 Wicker Man, the knowledge of this village actually being a pagan cult comes on slowly. Like, at first, it just looks like a regular sort of rural island British village, whereas in both the 2006 remake and in Midsommar, it's very obvious from a get-go that this is outside of the norm in some respect.
Yeah, well, in Midsommar, it's part of the appeal. As I said, it's a red rag to the postgrad bull, because you have these anthropology students who are there to study it. So they're entering with full knowledge that they're basically visiting a pagan cult. And that's also, I think, one of the interesting things it does is it plays with the fact that we know exactly where it's going quite well. You know, there's the only real twist, in a sense, is that Danny is recruited, because the rest of it, I mean, yes, not all of the audience will have seen the original Wicker Man, but like the fact that we already know it's a pagan cult, we already know it's a horror movie, the deaths start relatively early on, although they start with self-sacrifice rather than murder. Like, we know where it's going. Like, it uses that well. Like, whereas with Wicker Man 2006, that's kind of a problem. In this case, he's just like, well, okay, you know where this is going. It's all happening kind of in broad daylight. Like, so, you know, what could possibly happen to kind of make this, you know, to turn this into an interesting story? And it's essentially the sort of melodramatic breakup drama, and the sort of through that process, one of them being recruited and one of them being purged. That's essentially the big, you could say, innovation or twist in story terms. But like, it's also just to do with just how it's constructed, that it's just a compelling piece of work aesthetically and all that. But it is completely aware of the fact that you know where it's going, and it uses that well. You know, I don't think films always have to be unpredictable necessarily to be good.
Some of my favorite films begin with knowing exactly what is going to happen at the end. I don't want to bring Moulin Rouge into this, but I'm going to bring Moulin Rouge into this.
Right.
I know you don't like Moulin Rouge.
Yeah. No, I don't like it because of the karaoke approach to musicals.
I know. But my point being, you can have a film where you know exactly what's going to happen at the end, and yet when it happens at the end, it still works.
Yeah, yeah. And this is like, yeah, we know they're a pagan cult, and it's not a surprise to anyone that they're a murderous pagan cult. It's more about the character dynamics that play out, and I think this maybe is a hot take, but of everything we've discussed, probably the most sophisticated portrayal of cult dynamics, in that, like, okay, so the 1973 film presents the sort of the hierarchies of the cult and some of the, you know, maybe some of what's appealing about the cult. I'm not saying it's in any way lacking for the film, it is, but then to present this additional layer of actually how cults recruit people and how they prey on, like, isolation and trauma and, like, a need for community and meaning and fulfillment. You know, Danny's coming from this very alienated society, you know, contemporary US society. She's lost her family. So to have this this kind of sense of community and support, you know, is appealing. So
it's very much going into more what a cult is. It's into that dynamic, whereas the original Wicker Man, because they're not trying to recruit Howie, they're just trying to use him for their machinations, it doesn't look at that side of the cult dynamic, which is, yeah, something really cool that Midsommar does, and it's scary in and of itself.
It's scary partly because it's successful, you know, because it's able to make people sympathize with the recruitment. But he's the sacrifice. So we only have the perspective of the sacrifice. To flip the perspective and almost end with the POV of the film being the POV of the cult, which is also interesting because, yes, it's Danny as an individual, but part of it is drawing her into that collectivity. And there's definitely an element of how the cult works, which is to do with, like, collective feeling and collective subjectivity. So one thing they do is they mirror, basically, pain. So when the old people first sacrifice themselves, everyone in the cult, one of them is still in pain and doesn't die immediately. So everyone in the cult starts sort of mirroring their pain and sort of screaming and rending their clothes. You know, everyone is kind of expressing this kind of collective sense of, like, empathetic pain. And then the same thing when Christian, in quote marks, cheats. And I do find it ridiculous when people take that unironically as Christian cheating. But when he is manipulated into a drugged, ritualistic sort of sex scene, and Danny witnesses this and has an emotional breakdown, they the woman around her kind of mirror her pain and scream with her in a very well performed scene. And then, like, at the end, when Christian as well as the other sacrificers are burning alive, they all again begin screaming and rending their clothes, you know, mirroring the pain. So there's this idea of, like, collective subjectivity, and that, you know, if one person is hurt, every person is hurt. So, like, so for Danny, who's a very vulnerable person, you know, again, a traumatized, isolated person, to have that sense of, like, that other people will empathize, they'll feel your pain, they will literally mirror your pain. It's not even like they're just sort of like, oh yeah, you know, I'm very sympathetic to you, you've been through a tough time. They just, like, they feel your pain. So she's completely drawn into this kind of collective subjectivity. So I say at the end, it's not even just that we're seeing the protagonist, you know, the protagonist's POV of, like, a sort of sense of catharsis. It's kind of like we're experiencing the cult's sense of catharsis and essentially purging the outsiders, basically. So, yeah, fun times.
I think the thing that seems interesting to me about Midsommar, the way, like, you know, you've touched on the white supremacist angle of the cult, but the way that's almost seems to be like an underlying menace. Like it's obviously text, like, we know it's there, but if you're not really looking for it, it could slip under the radar, and it seems like it does for a lot of people.
Yeah, I mean, that article I sort of briefly mentioned on Boarded Utopias talks about this, that they compare it to Swedish social democracy and talk about Swedish social democracy as a kind of boarded utopia that, again, it has a collectivity, but the collectivity is premised on essentially purging the outsiders. And the movie does, I mean, I think very ironically and very self-awarely, but it does kind of present this utopia, you know, that it's like sunny meadow. You know, everyone seems happy and content, and you know, they're dancing.
Flowers and white robes and Birkenstocks.
Yeah, there's even like a quite funny moment, I think, where they're sort of dancing together and the other girls are speaking in Swedish, and Danny is like, I can't speak Swedish. But then it starts becoming subtitled and she's talking to them in Swedish, and they're like, they sort of say, we're communicating in dance, I think. So it's like she's being completely drawn into the subjectivity, which is a very, like, there's a lot of really heightened moments like that, like where we see there's really quite surreal subjective effects, partly because everyone's drugged, like they're drugging, yeah. They're drugging these people. But like the fact that she sort of experiences that she can apparently communicate with them in Swedish, it's kind of part of this, yeah, this utopian collectivity. And yeah, the fact that people can be drawn into it. Again, I don't know how much of the Good For Her stuff is just people being edgelords, and I kind of get it. But it does seem like there are people who've been sort of drawn into that and not sort of, it's sort of seem, you know, in some sense it's obvious, okay, so they're murderers. And, you know, when people are challenged on it, they'll say, well, like, obviously we know they're murderers. But it sort of goes beyond that. It's again, it's about the sort of the being drawn into to a cult through purging, again, the remnants of the outside world.
It is just, I think that's the most interesting and unique thing about Midsommar, and what makes it such a different film from The Wicker Man, is that is what you're seeing. It is a recruitment, a drawing in. It's not just a manipulation for the sacrificial purposes. It's manipulation to actually bring somebody into the fold, which is sinister in a completely different way, really.
I saw a really bad hot take on it, which was, I mean, in some ways, I get it, and it touches on what I said about anthropology postgrads being the worst. No diss on actual anthropology postgrads listening here. I'm a media studies postgrad, which is probably worse. But
I only did one anthro paper. I'm okay.
It's more. Like I find it funny as a postgrad, the way that they're depicted. But like, part of it is that they're like really competitive about who gets to document these people, and like, so I saw this take on it that it was about basically flipping the anthropological perspective, and that it was this kind of vengeance against the anthropologists, and that it was a kind of a reversal of perspective, similar to something like Cannibal Holocaust, where we kind of basically, you know, are seeing the anthropological perspective, and then that's flipped and is basically that there's a kind of victory over the anthropologists. But I think the big obvious problem with that is that, again, it's a white supremacist cult. Like, so anthropology, obviously, it may not be obvious to everyone, but for people who know anything about anthropology, it had a strong historical relationship with colonialism. I mean, it's long since taken a more critical turn in relation to that. You know, anthropology has very much, or large swathes of anthropology have very much rejected that relationship that the field initially had with anthropology. So I think that was underlying the point this person was making, that the anthropological perspective is kind of undermined. But I think in this case, considering it's a white supremacist cult, I think it's another case of, again, you don't really have to sympathize with either side of this. And to see it as like a liberating vengeance against anthropology, I feel is kind of somewhat missing the the context of what kind of cult this is. But yeah, well, and interesting thing about that also being that, of course, the person who's most defined by his anthropological perspective is himself a person of color. Sorry, a bit of a tangent, but it kind of reminds me of the recent Color Out of Space adaptation, where they have the kind of rational Lovecraft lead, because always in Lovecraft you have the rational scientist lead, yeah, who's essentially there to tell you that what's happening is scientifically unexplainable, that this is beyond our comprehension. But in this case, the sort of the rational outsider is a person of color, and the sort of the local community is white, and that's a reversal of what you often get in Lovecraft, where often people of color are kind of connected with the sort of the malicious alien forces, and you have
Lovecraft and people of color.
Yeah. Well, Lovecraft was a racist, but
yes.
Color Out of Space, and maybe a subtler way than, for example, Lovecraft Country. Lovecraft Country is great, but it's very overt in its kind of racial commentary on Lovecraft. Mm. In the case of Color Out of Space, it's not explicitly spelling out a perspective on that, but the fact that the rational outsider is a person of color kind of gives it an interesting kind of flip on Lovecraft's usual perspective. And so Midsommar kind of parallels that, where the anthropologist is a person of color, and the sort of the tribe almost, like, to use the problematic anthropological term, the sort of tribe that he's studying is a bunch of white supremacists. So I certainly don't think like the reversal of the anthropological perspective or the sort of vengeance against the anthropological perspective, I think taking that as any kind of liberation is as absurd as taking Danny's perspective as the kind of triumphant, you know, good for her kind of side of things. It is, as I said, very different from 2006, in that even though it could superficially appear to be kind of matriarchal, in that like we kind of have all these sequences of women in like a state of collectivity, and like women being idealized in some sense, this is all really contingent on women's reproductive functions for a white supremacist cult. So women are beautiful and valuable insofar as they can produce babies, essentially. But yeah, and white babies only.
Which is, yeah, very Nazi.
Yeah, very, very Nazi. Yeah, and there's a lot of like symbolic. Like I'm not an expert on this stuff, but if you look at the symbols they use, they're also white supremacist symbols. So like this is like definitely very deliberate, but also like I think you have to be watching it from a certain perspective to pick it up, you know. And I think Ari Aster is kind of playing a bit of a trick in that respect, in that if you're primed to be wary of a sort of a white supremacist utopia, then you know you're gonna see that. But if you're not, then you could be kind of drawn into it, and that's the kind of central trick of the film, I think. Anyway, I think we can probably start to wrap up. Sorry,
that's
probably
good.
We talked about Midsommar a lot, but so thanks for coming on the show, Lucy.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's been fun.
Yeah, it's always good to have a super fan on to sort of nerd about whatever it is that works for them. So thanks for listening, everyone. If you like what we do, please contribute to our Patreon at patreon.com/jetpack1917. Happy Halloween, and we'll see you in the future.
Kakite.
Willow's Song, composed by Paul Giovanni, performed by Folk Debt Band Camp.
I'll show to you.